Good afternoon to all of you. It's a pleasure to be with you. Hello to everyone out in video land. Welcome to the webcast, wherever you are in the islands of Canada. We have some in those areas. We're glad we can share the day with you. Sometimes in life you run into people that are similar to you. I found that this week when I met Paul. Paul is left-handed. He was writing and we were talking and he took a couple notes. I noticed his left hand working. And it was immediately a reaction of positiveness in the air because I'm left-handed. And so we had something to discuss. And being left-handed gave us a number of items to have of interest. He could be called by a nickname, Lefty. How many left-handed people do I have in here? Ah, friends. Nanu, Nanu. He told me about his aunt. And he was a little younger than I am, and when he told me about his aunt, he says, "She's about your age." Now, you know how that made me feel. But I went on with it, and he told me about his aunt, who was grew up, and she was a Jewess in Jewish household. Now, I didn't know this about his heritage, and I don't think it really matters. He doesn't seem to have significant interest in that. But in his discussion with me, he explained that when his aunt was young, they tried to make her write with her right hand. And that was never successful. And he says, to this day, her handwriting, her script is real sloppy. And you can't read it as well as you'd like. He thinks that if she had ever been allowed to use her left hand, it would have been a better writing. And I went through the same thing in the third grade. They tried to tell me to write with my right hand. Well, they did tell me, write with your right hand. And that went on for a few days until my dad wondered why I was writing with my right hand, and he went down to the school and straightened out that matter, and I've been thankfully left-handed ever since and in my right mind. But he asked me, why do you think the family wanted her to change from being left-handed to right-handed? The only thing that came to mind immediately was Matthew 25:32, where it says that you're going to have the sheep on the right and the goats on the left. So I mentioned that to him. And then there's a scripture in Ecclesiastes 10, verse 2, and it talks there about the wise are on the right hand, and the fools are on the left hand. And so this was our discussion, and we then moved on to other things. But sometimes nicknames do find themselves into our lives. You might be called, as I have been called a few times in life, Lefty. And I welcome it. I don't discourage it. I understand. I wish more people called me Slim, though. Slim's a nickname, isn't it? Shoeless Joe. Some of you know of that story. There's a nickname. Stuck around for a long time, still is. How about Blondie? If you're in a mall or a store, you want your wife's attention, you say, "Hey, Blondie," you'll get four people looking at you. Interesting, isn't it? This got me to thinking about the seven dwarfs. Does anybody have their names memorized? Wow. St. Pete has you beat. There's a woman over there, a young lady, who knows all seven of them. Grumpy, Dopey, Doc, Sleepy, Sneezy, Happy, and Bashful. And you would look to those as being somewhat nicknames. Well, there's a story in the Bible that I was stirred on from a question proposed to me last week over in the congregation in Vero Beach. That congregation is growing, and I think last week we had 27, and it's moving forward. We have new people interested, and I think there'll be possibly three, that would be new there today. I hope so. But in the Bible, a question from the Bible came forward about a man named Nabal. In 1 Samuel 25, there's a story of Nabal and Abigail. And at the end of the story, another one gets involved, David. Now, Nabal means foolish. And if you want other nicknames, we could call Abigail Abby. And David, we can just call him plain old Dave. So there are some other names that come into this chapter. I want to read to you this, or more major portions of 25. I want you to read through it with me. And I've led you down somewhat of a garden path with nicknames. But it brings me to this introduction point of realizing sometimes what you're called and what you do stays with you. It's very important that your style of life, your behavior, reflect very positively about you. You don't want a bad nickname. And in this chapter, Samuel dies, and it says that there was in Mount Carmel, verse 2, a man who was very great, and he had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. And he had shepherds up there watching them. Now this man's name, it says, was Nabal. And the name of his wife was Abigail. She was a woman of good understanding and a beautiful countenance. But the man was churlish and evil in his doings. He was of the house of Caleb. So here is a very reactionary man, evidently, churlish and stingy. Well, David heard in the wilderness about Nabal and his sheep, and he had sent out 10 men, it says, in verse 5, tell them to go up to get to Carmel and go to Nabal, greet him in my name. Say to him that he lives in prosperity, and peace be with you, to both you and your house and all that you have. Now I've heard that you have shearers, and the shepherds have been with us. We didn't hurt them, neither was there anything missing from them. And all the while when they were working in Mount Carmel. And so he says, ask your young men and they will show you that indeed we've looked after them and helped them. And so let the young men find favor in your eyes, for we have come in a good day. Give, I ask you, whatever is in your hand. Give it to the servants and to your son David. Well, they told that to Nabal, according to all those words, and they did it in the name of David. And then Nabal gives the answer in verses 10 and 11. And Nabal answered David's servants and said, who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? There be many servants nowadays that break away from their master. Shall they take my bread, my water, my flesh that I have killed for my shearers and give it unto men whom I know not from whence they come? So his churlishness, his stinginess comes out. Well, David's men turned again and came and told David all these sayings. And in 13, David becomes extremely irate. He says, every man here, put on your sword. So they did that, and they went up after David, about 400 men. They left 200 to take care of the camp. Well, when one of the younger men of this heard of what was going on, he came and told Abigail, Nabal's wife. She says, David sent messengers out of the wilderness to salute our master, and he railed on them. He did something very foolish. He didn't take his time to consider. Now, those men have been very good to us, and we have not hurt were not hurt, neither missed we anything, as long as they were conversant with them, and we were in the fields. They were a wall between us and anything else that might hurt us by night and day. So we want you to know and consider what you should do. For our master is against everything and against all his household. And this man David is such a son, or Nabal is such a son of Baal, that a man cannot speak to him. So here's a man of confusion, quick with tongue, very churlish and greedy. And maybe that's how he got his 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. But he's known, his name is Nabal, and perhaps that is his given name. But it might just be his nickname, because he was foolish, and he was a fool to do such a thing. Well, Abigail made haste, and 18 it says she took 200 loaves, 2 bottles of wine, 5 sheep dressed, 5 measures of parched corn, 100 clusters of raisins, 200 cakes of figs, and she got up onto the area where David would be coming down. And so when she finds him, she says she saw David in verse 23 and 24. She fell at his feet and says, "Upon me, my Lord, upon me let it this iniquity be, and let not your handmaid, I pray you, speak in your audience, hear my words, please. Let not my Lord, I ask you, regard this man of Belial, even Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him." And the young men of the Lord whom that you did send, they were good. So as this went on in the conversation, we find in 27, "Now this blessing which your handmaid has brought unto my Lord, let it even be given unto the young men that follow my Lord. I pray you forgive the trespass of your handmaid, for the Lord will certainly make my Lord, David, a sure house, because the Lord fights the battles, this man fights the battles of the Lord, and evil has not been found in you all your days." And so she gives him all of this, and David's now comes to a complete different perspective. He says in 31, "No grief will come to you, no offense or hurt or heart of the Lord. Neither will you have any shedding of blood careless, causeless, or that my Lord has avenged himself. But when the Lord shall have dwelt well with my Lord, remember your handmaid." So David said to Abigail, Abby, "Blessed be the Lord God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. And blessed be your advice, and blessed be you which have kept me this day from coming to shed blood and from avenging myself with my own hand." Part of the story that we may not think of sometimes is that David was very rash here as well. First thing that he heard when he was repelled and received was, "Get your swords, we're going to go kill him." And the only one in between was Abby, who seemed to understand there was a time to try to make peace. We don't need useless bloodshed. And so she rode and presented a gift, and the peace was then rather attained. Now it came her time finally to tell her husband what had happened. And as the story goes, when she told him what had happened, he had a stroke. And the chapter goes on to explain that after 10 days, the man died, which is not an unusual thing. 10 days of a stroke and not being able to have nourishment is typical time for a death to take place. And when she was then free of her husband, David then married her. Again, remember, she said she was good looking. So it says something to us in all of this story that I think is sometimes missed. I mean, we read the story and we see how important it is to have wisdom. Perhaps that's what we see in it. But you see, both the husband, Nabal, and also David, who became the adversary, had a quickness about them that would not serve the end result properly. They didn't know how to see to the end of things. And the one in the middle, Abigail, she saw what the end result would be of Nabal not giving a gift and of David coming with all of his crew and the slaughter to take place. She saw further down the road. She anticipated. She took the time to look it over and arrive at some conclusions. You see, Nabal and David saw the immediate situation. Abigail saw where it could all end up. And I present to you that she had a full appreciation of all that is life and why she was living and what her goals in life would be. Now, we all need to rationally be aware of our own lives because you never know when the end will come. And whether you've got a nickname or a real name, no matter what you did in your youth to earn you some nickname, now you have these days in front of you. And it's important that you put together in your life the kind of package that Abigail had, where she could go forward and offer peace. Now, in the book of Ecclesiastes, there's many things said about wisdom. Wisdom is cemented in place when you understand why. And so I told you via internet, the title is The Meaning of Why. X, Y, Z, that why. I mean W-H-Y. That was to pique your curiosity. Why? Abigail thought about, why do we do this? I don't see any question in the minds of David or Nabal saying, why am I going to do this? They just react. They go do what they're going to do, and they don't consider the end result of all that is life. You and I need to know there is a time, and many times, to ask why. The fool never comes to ask why. The fool knows many things. He knows who, what, when, and where. Sometimes some of those are missing. But he knows who, what, when, and where. But rarely does he tumble to asking why. Now, when you go back and you think of your school days, and you're doing your composition course in high school, and you're being graded for, do you have enough words? Do you have enough paragraphs? You're being challenged with your penmanship, at least back in those days. And your teacher looks at your composition and gives you a B+. And possibly the answer was, you left out one of the five. Who, what, when, where, why? If you want the A, you need to ask why. And when you come into this Christian activity, following Christ, you need to have an answer for why. Sometimes we get together, but we forget that part of the composition. I want to read through Ecclesiastes 9 and portions of chapter 10 with you. Probably not turn to that much, but in this chapter, we will find many places where while the word why isn't there, it is the subtitle of many of the examples. In Ecclesiastes 9:1, for all this I considered in my heart, even to declare all this, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. Everything that happens, God is completely aware of. No man knows either love nor hatred, but all that is before them. So when we come out of the womb, we are a blank slate. We're like a blank book. And what we take in, through whatever our parents teach us, what our environment teaches us, what we've learned in school, what we learn from our friends and our cousins, that is how we then start to frame the kind of person that we are. In the sermonette, we heard about a man who, his background framed him into being a member of the KKK. You have been framed by your background. And somewhere along the line, you realized it wasn't as whole and perfect as it should be. And so you've entered into a reframing project. But we need to remember that we all start with clean slates. And you then with children, or you that would have children, realize you are writing on a slate. And one of the things you need to write on that slate with your youth is not just who, what, when, and where, but also why. All things come alike to all. We all have the same things. You wouldn't think it, but probably a lot of us have walked the same road with the same thoughts. We have turned into different people because of how we handled those opportunities or distractions. But all things come alike to all. There is one of it to the righteous and to the wicked. There's one thing that happens to everybody. To the good and to the clean. To the unclean. To him that sacrifices and to him that doesn't. As is the good, so is the sinner. And he that swears is him that refuses to take an oath. There's one thing that happens to everyone. There is an evil among all things that are done under the sun. That there is one event, though, that happens to us all. Yes, the heart of the sons of men is full of evil. What happens to us all is we all have to fight jealousy, vanity, lust, and greed. We all have to move away from a satanic pull towards the center and be Christ-centered, kingdom-seeking. So the heart of the sons of men is full of evil, and madness is in their heart. While they live, and after that, they go to the dead. And that's what we have in common with everyone. Whether it's a person that you would find so hideous in their activities, whether it be someone of the red light district, whether it be someone that's a beggar on the corner, whether it be the one who's a trained marksman in the military, whether he be a leader in Egypt, we all go to one place. Now that thought doesn't come to us often enough, I don't think. We don't think that we, every day that death could have come. We don't think that often enough. Now in 4, for unto him that is joined to all the living there is hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. Even if you haven't done much and you only be considered a dog by some, at least you have life. You have something to work with. The dead cannot work with what they have nothing of. And so your worth is what you have today. Because when you're dead, you have no worth. The living know that they shall die, but the dead know not anything. Neither have they any more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. And you can go to the cemeteries as well as I can and see the grave markers that are not kept with the plastic flowers. People who have passed away, and no one cares. My dad and mother buried together in Arizona. I will see their grave seldom. And I don't know, Dad didn't think it did any good to go visit it. And I said, well, I'm going to anyhow. This month is the month he passed. My sisters, I doubt, will ever come, although they live in California. It isn't part of who they are. They're my sisters, I love them. But they have a different walk than I do. And so when you look at the graveyards, it should sober you to realize that is where you will be. And so today is the day that you have for action in your life. And I want you to be asking why a lot more than you do. Most of us know who we are, where we are. We know when to come and how to be. But sometimes we don't ask and know why. Verse 6, also their love and their hatred, their envy is now perished. So when you go, someone that was real churlish, as the word is for Nabal, his habits of greed died with him. And you just can't take anything with you. Neither have they any more a portion forever in anything that is done under the sun. Nothing is left for them to work with. So our portion, our lot is here today. So go your way, eat your bread with joy. Absolutely. I love that verse. Eat your bread with joy, and the next part even gets better. Drink your wine with a merry heart. So I can sit with my wife and have a good meal. Don't drink too much wine anymore. I'm not supposed to eat bread. But I can look at joy. And that's worth a lot. For God now accepts your works. Today, if I will do things right, He will accept what I am doing and log that so that eventually there's enough notation that the book of life will include the name Zimmerman. And you walk through your life and make sure the good works are there so the log will include your name. Let your garments be always white and let the head lack no ointment. In other words, use your head. Watch what you do. Be clean in everything you do. Do what is right, because judgment is on you now. Live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your life, of your vanity, of your temporariness, which God has given you under the sun, all the days of your vanity. For there is your portion in this life, and in your labor which you take under the sun. So whatever your hand finds to do, it says, do it with your might. It says in, I think, Proverbs 24, the hand of the diligent shall bear rule. Now you're doing these things, though, in a godly way, knowing who, what, when, where, and asking why. For there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave. It's only with you today. And how you pile it up is very important. I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill. Time and chance happens to all. I have a few good friends in life that have been extremely successful. And I've wanted to learn from them, and I have. And I asked them, well, what happened? You got into this situation and then ended up in such a place of achievement. And their answer is the same as the biblical one. Time and chance. They had prepared themselves for the future, though. And that's a very important matter. They saw to the end. They knew why they wanted to do some things. For men also know not this time. You don't know the fish taking an evil. Fish don't know they're going to be caught. The birds don't know they're going to be trapped. Well, the sons of men can be snared in an evil time. It'll fall upon them suddenly. So just as you don't know when you're going to catch a fish, and the bird doesn't know when he's going to be trapped, we don't know what's going to happen to us. So you've got to be very careful about asking why you were doing some things. The things that are going to take you in the right direction. And so when someone does something that gets them in trouble, no wonder we call them bird brains. Kind of an ugly nickname, isn't it? They just aren't thinking. They don't see what's around them. They aren't asking why they're going in the direction they're going. They're just going do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. For this wisdom have I seen also under the sun, and I seem to think that it's one of the greatest ones. He says, here's something that is real solid that I can take with me, and I think it's very basic for you to understand. I want to give you then a proverb, he says. There was a little city, there were a few men within it. And there came a great king against it. They besieged it and built great bulwarks against it. Now it was found in that city a poor wise man, and he by his wisdom delivered the city. Yet no man remembered that same poor man. People don't remember. I can remember the first funeral I went to. And if it hadn't been my Grandpa Philip, when I was 4, I wouldn't remember that at all as far as the name. Do you know how many funerals I've performed or in my lifetime? I don't. I can tell you it's a lot, but I'm challenged to tell you the names. When you die, it's not too long, and all that is about you is forgotten. Even if you were a small, wise, but poor little man. So I said, wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard. So he's not around. He's gone. The words of wise men are heard in quiet more than in the city cry of them that rule among fools. So wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. In chapter 10, there's a few more jewels here. Talking about dead flies making the ointment stink. You know, if you put out something and it goes rotten, drawing flies, you got to get rid of it and just do that as fast as you can. He says it's the very same thing with a little folly. It can bring a real bad reputation to you, just a little folly. A wise heart is at the right hand, but a fool's heart at his left. That's what I was telling you earlier. But this isn't talking about left-handed and right-handed people. Just some people go down the wrong path. We all have the choice. And we can all be here, but some of us could be kicking the fences and going across every so often. Maybe not dangerously so, or that's what we think. But we sometimes don't stop and think about why we do some things. If the spirit of the ruler rises up against you, leave not your place. Yielding pacifies great offenses. Just be patient, say kind things, listen, respond when you've got some sanity about it. Don't be reactionary like this Nabal or Nabal. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun as an error which proceeds from the ruler. Folly is set in the great is set in great dignity, and the rich sit in low places. Sometimes we have a reversal of roles. I have seen servants upon horses and princes walking as servants upon the earth. He that digs a pit shall fall into it, and whoever breaks a hedge, he'll be bitten by a snake. You start removing stones, well, they're going to fall on you. And he that tries to split wood can be endangered by it. Maybe his axe is blunt, so he doesn't sharpen that edge. And so when he has to try to split it, requires more strength. And so people need to be sharp about the way in which they're going. You want to split into the right position and decisions. Be very careful. Don't stick your hand in hedges that you don't know what's in there. Don't start removing rocks if you don't know what's going to start rolling in your direction. Know why you do some things. Stop and look. If I take this rock, is everything going to start tumbling down? If I take this job, is it going to help me? Why am I taking this job? Surely the serpent will bite without an enchantment. A snake will bite you. You've all seen snakes in this land, haven't you? Some of you might have been snapped at or bitten by them. And a babbler is no better. Just like a snake with, you know, it's been messed with. We need to realize that we live in a day and age where you can babble and it'll get you caught. We've got so much going on in our lives. We talk, we phone, we text, we get on the internet and we get into Facebook and all these things, and we drop little notes, and it's the world knowing about us. Nothing's private anymore. And that's what the previous scriptures were telling us. Don't say something out of school. If you're going to say something, be careful to say the right and good thing. Be very careful. For the words of a man's mouth, the words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of a fool will swallow up himself. The beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is mischievous madness. You start going down a trail and people start making comments. I see on the internet forums sometimes, and they're talking about this and that, and it just leads on and on and on. Before you know it, it just is senseless. We've gotten so far afield of the topic, and unfortunately we tend to waste our time on some of that. A fool also is full of words. A man cannot tell what shall be and what shall not, or what shall be after him. Who can tell him? Now the labor of the foolish worries every one of them, because he knows not how to go to the city. So he says in the next few four paragraphs, like real small things. Woe to them, O land, when the king is a child and your princes eat in the morning. Blessed are you, O land, when the king is the son of nobles and the princes eat in due season, for strength and not for drunkenness. We live in a time when God has given us leadership that is inadequate. We need to remember to pray for that. By much slothfulness, the building decays, and through idleness of the hands, the house drops through. Talking about caring for what you have. Thinking about what you're doing. A feast is made for laughter, and wine makes the heart merry, but money answers a lot of things. And unless you're thinking through it and have a why, and you're saving up for the rainy day, you can't find yourself with the money to answer many things. And finally, in 20, curse not the king, nor in your thought, and curse not the rich in the bedchamber. You'll find there's a bird of the air that'll carry your voice, and that which has wings shall tell the matter. Our system is coming to an end. Our age is wavering and just about ready to fall. Egypt is an illustration of that. Some say it's reforming, some say it's disintegrating. Take your choice. But you see, when I look at Egypt and Egyptians firing upon and killing fellow Egyptians, I have to come to the consideration, has anybody asked why? They're killing each other. They know how they want to live, but why do they want to kill somebody? Now, the fall festivals of the Eternal prophesy the fulfillment of God's irrevocable covenants. These contracts that God made with mankind are coming in our fall festival season very shortly. And you need to consider this question of why, as you prepare to go to the feasts. As you look around you, you see a world that doesn't ask why. I've just taken you through a large section of Ecclesiastes where it's important for you to see the end of days will come, and it's important that you ask why you do certain things. I've shown you an example of Nabal and David, who had just moved quickly and without serious consideration, looking out to the future, knowing why they were doing that and where they were leading themselves and their people. For those who know why about God's covenants and why He made those covenants with mankind, and they understand, for those who consider the fact and know where these all lead, there's a great refreshing and reward awaiting them. Now in Isaiah 58 through chapter 60, the holy days are mentioned. Let's look over at Isaiah 58. For those of you in the local Bible study, this might be slightly repetitious. I suppose we all can learn from some of that, though. But we see in 58:1, cry aloud, spare not. Lift up your voice like a trumpet. Show my people their transgression, and the house of Jacob their sins. Trumpets is mentioned here. The Feast of Trumpets is coming. We are heralding the needs of our nation and all mankind to repent. This is what we're called to do. We're called to do it even though people are seeking Him daily, trying to find His way. They think that they're doing it, but it's not arriving at the realities. So in verse 3, He talks about fasting. After the Feast of Trumpets comes the time of fasting, atonement. Why have you fasted, they say, and you've not seen it? And so the fasting that takes place on atonement is mentioned. We have trumpets mentioned, atonement mentioned. And on it goes for many scriptures. Then it says in 13 about the Sabbath. You should turn your foot away from the Sabbath, from your own pleasure, from doing your own ways, from doing your own words. This will be a delight to God. And this is a very important matter for us to consider. The challenging reality of these chapters show us what Christ is going to face when He comes back, establishes His kingdom, but there is not resolution to all of the problems facing mankind. And chapters 59 and 60 explain the time of change that is going to take place. We see it only in the eyes, perhaps the little thought of Well, if they don't keep the feast, there won't be any rain on them for a year. Look at what is covered in 59 and 60. There's a lot of terrible times for mankind to face that survive the war and the atrocities at the time of the return of Christ. There's a lot of problems. The Lord's hand is not shortened that it cannot save, neither his ear heavy that it cannot hear. But your iniquities have separated between you and your God, and your sins have hid his face from you that he will not hear. And if you read through the chapters, you'll see that there is this important matter that Christ is going to redirect the course of man. Today we have to understand who directs the course of mankind towards the coming kingdom and the establishment of that kingdom. Why is he bringing that kingdom? Sometimes we know who is going to do it. We know where it is going to be, and we spend a lot of time on Jerusalem and Mount of Olives cleaving in two. We think of the New Jerusalem. When it's going to happen, we hope shortly, and sometimes we get involved with a lot of calculation and theory, trying to figure out when. We hope we're part of the people are there. We want to be there. Who is going to be there? I'm going to be there. But why? Is God satisfied that you know what you're doing and you have a reason for it? Have you stumbled into these things and you're doing them rudimentally but not really thinking about what the purpose in your life is? Now, my friend Lefty, Paul, when he found out that his aunt was made to write left-handed basically because of superstition, he says, how about that? Superstition. What a terrible reason to alter life. And you've got to have a reason why you have altered your life. When you write that theme paper and you come up with who, what, when, and where, they'll dominate a lot of the report. But why? Have you chosen a topic that lets you explain why? Now, this area of discussion, knowing why you do things, enters into an area that I'll call spiritual discernment. To discern why you are going in a direction that has spiritual intent. We had a mention today earlier of 1995. And we made a significant choice to keep God's laws and his instructions. And we think we know why. But I think sometimes we have a lot of discussion yet to do about why. And why needs an answer. Today in the sermonette, Mr. Summers brought up the subject of the Sabbath. He mentioned Leviticus 23. And in the sermon, or sermonette, he'd explained that we're to be together in a holy convocation. Now, can you spend a lot of time preparing for the Sabbath, not working, keeping it holy, making sure that all these little things work together, but have you done so much physical things you don't enter into a discussion of why you were doing it? And the why is right there in Leviticus 23. So you can come together and let iron sharpen iron and find instruction. Find unity. Find progress towards the future. And that's why, as he was mentioning, that can only happen when you challenge attendance every possible time. It is important for you to take that very sincerely. 1 week leads to 2 weeks, leads to how many weeks? And so we keep the Sabbath, but why? And we're missing the whole point of Leviticus 23. That it's a holy convocation. And we can sit home and do what we can to keep it. But why? Why are you doing that at home? The fall festivals come shortly. And I think it's important, I know it's important, for every time you come to those assemblies, you ask, why? Now, being working with the festivals for decades, I was really surprised this year at the response I got, secondhand albeit, of why one person wanted to come to Jamaica. Well, when we go there, it's all inclusive. And I can have as much alcohol to drink as I want. It's free. That's why I want to go to the feast in Jamaica. That is so far out of why you should do anything. And I wouldn't think that you would come up with that idea, would you? But would you spend more time on food, beverage, even though it may not be alcoholic, gifts? Would that dominate your time and the side trips back and forth as compared to your relationship and learning about your future and why you have come to the feast? Will you find yourself disregarding your needs and become sick, not feeling well, ill, because you haven't done what you should do by your body? And so you give yourself, well, I can't go today. And yet you've spent this vast amount of money to get there, but you're sick because you haven't taken care of yourself. So you need to ask, why do you go to the feast? And that you go prepared to be there. They're holy convocations. They aren't vacation time. Yeah, your family can come and be with you, but it's not for that. It's for you to have a relationship and look into the future. That is why you go. And if you find yourself some days spending more time thinking about the recreation that you can enjoy than the service that you're learning from, you've got it backwards. Yeah, you know who you are. You're part of the United Church of God. Where you are, you're at the feast site. When? Well, services are at 10 o'clock. Where? Oh, they're over there. Why are you going over there? Well, that's where church is. If that's your answer, think further. Marriage. Why do you have marriage? Why did you marry her? I thought she was good looking. Her daddy had money. He had a nice car, a vet. Anybody in here get married because of had a vet? Did I just touch a toe? I hope not. Why are you married? Why are you involved with someone of the opposite sex and living together? Why are you married? It's because you like eggs and bacon? It's all beef? Why? You know? She made the best crumb cake? He knew how to fix a flat? Why? We get married sometimes really not thinking about it. And that's part of immaturity. And we'll have to grant ourselves a little freedom there, won't we? We know who we're going to marry, what the service will be like, when it's going to be, and where it's going to be, but why get married? And as your days go on, I hope you tumble to that. Why am I married to this person? Your understanding of why will be seen in the fruit of your relationship. And whether you like it or not, everybody else sees it all the time. The fruit of your relationship is an open book. People see whether it's beautiful or a little off center. People see that. You may think you're deceiving everybody by whatever your response you have, but people see that. Child rearing. Why do we have children? Well, I know how. I know a lady that basically lived her life that way. Young girl in the congregation, baptized, and she was in and out of church I don't know how many times over the decades that I worked with her. I think she ended up with 7 children from 6 different men. She knew how to have babies. She didn't know what to do with them. Why do you have your children? Do you know that the answer to that question? You know, sometimes you know who your children are, and so does everybody else. Everybody knows the who and where they are. But why do we have children? Have you sat them down and looked at them as a potential God and continue to work with them in a positive way, building and reinforcing a very positive and beautiful environment for them, giving them an answer to why they have life? Now, there's a little boy or two back in this corner over here, and I've visited Randy's house a few times, and I've seen those boys say, why, many, many times. Why? All of you that have had kids asking why. And they'll ask, why, and then you get so fed up with it, you say, shut up and quit talking so much. When they're asking absolutely the right question. And if you sat down and answered one of their whys, they'd probably be fed up with it in a minute and say, thank you. Maybe not thank you, but they say, I'm going to go. It's important that your children know why. So bringing this to the 4 o'clock end, what is your concept of why? Do you ask why enough in life? As you walk through every door, every opportunity, going to church, going to the holy days, going to the grocery store, driving somewhere, do you ask and can you say why you are going and know that it's a right reason? Before you talk, can you say something? And before you say anything, do you know that you have enough guard in your mind to say the right thing because you know why it should be said or why it should be written? You must consider the meaning of why. The theme paper is being written by you. God knows who you are, where you are. He knows you know who you are. And you know where you are. He knows how you're doing. And you think you know how you're doing. Who, what, when? Right now. But does God know why? Because you know why. As you write the theme paper that's going to be delivered up there to see if you qualify to be written in the Book of Life, make sure you answer the question, I know the meaning of why.